Well, the world is a dumpster fire, and nothing here makes sense. And you're vacillating between crippling fear and constant self-defense. And nothing's right, and nothing's good, and you're paralyzed with grief. Don't kill yourself, just have a cup of coffee.
Welcome to Coffee Over Suicide, the dramedy podcast about mental illness and choosing life over death, one cup of coffee at a time. I'm your host, Chris Parker Howard. And today on the show, we have got recovery expert, musician extraordinaire, and all-around mental health badass, Dr. Rob Kelly. And this is episode 100 of Coffee Over Suicide. I've had 100 of these conversations, and I cannot thank everybody enough for the support and also the high level of enthusiasm from each and every one of you about the topic that we are tackling here. I do have to let you know right off the bat, right at the top of this episode, as I sometimes do, that I am not a licensed professional. I am just some guy who has gone through a lot of stuff and has a lot of ideas that I picked up along the way trying to figure it out. You'll get about as much help from me as you would having a great conversation with a good-natured dog. You'll probably feel better at the end of it, but was it the dog or was it you just working out your stuff? Could be a little both. I like to think that I'm a good-natured dog. This is off the rails already, and that leads me into the next thing I want to say. I wanted to let you know that this is actually going to be the season finale for season 3 of Coffee Over Suicide, and there are a couple of reasons why I made that decision. Number one, 100 is a great place to put a bookmark in and take a look at everything that's been accomplished so far, and where I want to improve moving forward. Things that I want to change, things that I'd like to do better, things that I'd like to add or even remove. It's just a great place to assess and retool and reinvigorate. I want to come back with 1,000% more of everything that made this work for the next season. When is that going to be? I'll let you know. Because that leads me to the second part. The second part is this conversation is an excellent one. In fact, it's one of the best ones I've had on the entire 3 seasons of this show. I love it so much. It felt like a great finale. Something to really chew on and mull over and maybe even listen to more than once. And I also want to let you know that if you are struggling with finding the right recovery program for you, if you're struggling with your therapist, if you're struggling with anxiety, trauma, depression, grief, loss, stress management, all of the things that we talk about on this show, if you're struggling with something and you're looking for assistance, go to robkelly.com, robkelly.com. Tell you what, do me a favor, just go to the website and go to the Our Philosophy tab. Right there on the front page of the website, there's a tab for Our Philosophy, and you can see what they're all about. And they're about everything that this show is about. It's about eliminating your fear-based thinking. It's about behavior. It's really, really fantastic. I urge you all to check it out, whether you've got any sort of issues or not. It's always great to have some more ammunition for the clip. You know what I'm saying? So, without further ado, let's get into this conversation with the amazing Dr. Rob Kelly. You with me?
Oh, there you go. Sorry.
You know, technology is so wonderful. It can connect us all over the globe poorly.
Amazing. Good morning, guys. Good morning, Chris. How are you?
I'm doing well. Working out the muscles, getting some stretching on. That's all very, very important.
Yeah.
Especially these days.
Yes, definitely.
So tell me.
I find out the older I get, the more stretching I need to do. And the older I get, the more noise I make whilst getting up.
Oh, man. You are not kidding about any of that. Not to put too much of a time stamp on the recording here, but we are just a couple of days away from my 44th birthday.
Woohoo!
Yeah. And it is definitely noticeable. It takes a lot more effort. I just recently decided that it would be a good idea for me to get back into skateboarding.
Oh, and, nice.
Man, two things about that. One, it is incredible fun. There's such a freedom to it, a feeling of expression. Everything that I loved about it came back almost immediately. Yeah. What did not come back immediately was the pain that I felt in my thighs, knees, and ankles.
Yeah.
Just an incredible, intense workout. And now I know why I was so skinny when I was a kid.
That's so true. So true.
So tell me about you. Let's go back a little bit, because you've got a very interesting story that even starts pretty young for a lot of people. Where did you grow up?
Grew up in Manchester, United Kingdom, and started drinking at the age of 9. I mean, I know it sounds crazy, but that's the time when I started. And just grew up in Manchester, went down to Oxford to get educated, and then met about 13, 14 years ago, came over to the United States, and absolutely love it. Completely love what I do, completely love where I live. We're lucky because most of my life we've been heading towards what we call our dream house.
Yeah.
So we always wanted to have this fantastic dream house. So we're in it. We're in the dream house. I'm driving my dream car. I live with my dream wife. I mean, I'm just living the dream today. I always say I'm living the dream instead of dreaming the living.
Yeah.
Because my story is horrendous, and it's the worst story I've heard because it's my story, obviously.
Right.
From where I come from, because I ended up homeless, suicidal. On two occasions, I actually did commit suicide, and they brought me back. So where I am today is just an absolute, probably 0.0001% of a chance of doing what I'm doing. So I'm so blessed to be here. I'm so happy to be here. And I'm so energized and also passionate about what I do.
You know, I think that one of the things that I notice is that with a lot of people, especially with a lot of mental health issues and things of that nature, specifically suicidality, which is something that I talk about with people quite a lot. One of the factors that I tend to notice is that the conversations about that help to define the person's feelings toward it, and it's almost an education issue in some ways. And I have to imagine, well, I don't have to completely imagine, because I've got my own stories as far as alcohol addiction and things like that. But I have to imagine that there's a piece of that that's the same as far as how that addiction is fed, fostered, and hidden. Can you tell me a little bit about what kind of atmosphere gives the option of alcohol to a 9-year-old?
Well, it's not crazy how it happened, but this is what happened to me.
Yeah.
So when I'm 9, I don't understand a lot about alcohol, obviously. But when I'm 9, I'm with a musical family, so I'm on stage every Friday and Saturday and Sunday night. Mm-hmm. So I didn't really have a normal childhood because I didn't listen to a lot of music. So I missed out on Pink Floyd and all them people. In fact, I heard an amazing song that I thought was new. And I run downstairs to my wife and said, "Have you heard this?" And it was "Wish You Were Here" by Pink Floyd. And she's like, "Really? That was in the 80s. I'm like, "Well, I didn't used to listen to music." because we've been rehearsing every week.
Oh yeah.
So I'm a very nervous kid. We're doing new songs every week. My uncle and auntie is who I'm with, and we played at this place called Liverpool Irish Centre, and it was the biggest place we ever played. There must have been about 1,000 people there. Well, when the curtains opened, I just froze. I mean, a 9-year-old kid with this huge bass guitar on his neck.
Yeah.
You know, just froze completely. So when we went off into the side, into the green room during the break, my aunt always just said, I can't go back on. I just can't. I'm so nervous. So my uncle said, hey, just take a couple of swigs of this beer. And that's where it all started. So there wasn't such a much as an attraction to it. It was more of when I took the first drink, everything changed in my world in an instant.
Yeah.
And I always go back and say to people, because I did my research after this, of people my own age, hey, were you 9 or 10, 11? Did you have your first drink? Oh, yeah, my dad gave me his beer. What was it like? Oh, my God, it was awful. I was sick. I spat it out. That was never the case with me.
Yeah.
My first drink was, holy moly, what the hell have I just found? I found a solution to life. I wanted to go and call all my friends up and tell them, I found a solution to all our problems, guys. And during my teens, it was the same thing. You know, this amazing golden liquid means I could speak to women or girls.
Yep.
I could date girls. I could be the cool guy. You know, I was always the shy guy. And the crazy thing is I'm still shy today. It's just that when I go on radio, TV, or when I'm out or working with people or in the public eye, I have this passion and aggression that most people love and some people are scared of. It's because, you know, when you mention addiction or stuff like that, I get really passionate. But deep down inside, I'm still that shy guy. You know, I'm still the guy that really wants you to like me, because if only you found out who I really am, of course you won't like me. And I hear this time and time again with newcomers, but I still carry that. And I think I'll carry that to the rest of my life. And the old saying, the nursery rhyme, is sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me, is not true for me. You know, you can devastate me with it. In fact, I was doing a talk in California, in L.A., and there was literally 1,000 people were invited, and 1,000 people turned up, Chris. And what happened was, after the speech, it's customary, because it was an unpaid gig, for everybody in that room, they give 45 minutes after for everyone to come up and shake my hand and say, obviously, what they thought. I am not kidding when I say this. 999 people said I was amazing. In fact, most of them people said that the talk changed their life. A couple of people said they had a spiritual experience, and about 30 people said they cried while listening to my story. And what an inspiration. And one guy said, you were crap. You were too loud. You were too aggressive. And I don't know why you're doing this. Have a guess who I focused on for the next 3 months.
Yeah.
And relapsed on.
Oh,
and that's
man.
The power. So it really made me think of how powerful are words. So I started to do my own research. And funny enough, many, many years later, I'm in the practice, and we just finished with a guy, beautiful guy, and David L, I think it was. And we said our goodbyes, and reception said bye, and he went. And about 10 minutes later, my receptionist come in. He said, oh, my God, Dr. Kelly, I've got some bad news. Dave L, who's just left, his father's been in a car accident on the freeway, and he's dead. He's died. It's been fatal. And they've called the office because he thought he was here. So I said, don't worry, I'll call him. So I called him up, and I told him, you know, the best way I could over the phone. And he was describing, he said, my body's shaking, I'm crying, I've just wet myself, I'm shaking uncontrollably. Dr. Rock, can you get somebody here to drive my car because my body has gone to pieces? Well, obviously it would do, you know, so I'm sympathizing for him. And I put the phone down, and my assistant burst through the door. She never even knocked. And I thought, oh, my God. And she come running up to the table, and she said, Dr. Rob, we've got the wrong Dave. It's Dave B, not Dave L, whose dad's died. So I'm like, oh, my God, you called Dave B. I'm going to call Dave L back. So I called him back, and we sorted it out. And it wasn't the end of the world. But when I put the phone down, it made me think. My words over a phone wasn't even true. We had the wrong guy. Yet my words had the power to change him completely. His body, his shakes, his sweating, his hysterical crying, him wetting, all these stuff changed from words.
Yes.
Just words, Chris. It wasn't even, you know, I wasn't even face to face with him. So he couldn't see my facial features and my sadness. It was just words over the phone. And it took on a new meaning for me. Is if we can devastate somebody that quickly, how quickly can we lift somebody up with the right words?
Absolutely. And the story that we tell ourselves about our reality is an agreement that we are making with ourselves and our surroundings. You know what I mean? It's that whole thing of, I mean, you tell yourself that you're garbage, then you accept that as the reality of the situation. You tell yourself that things can't get better. You accept that as the reality of the situation. And even if you're trying to solve problems, like when I was a kid, I told myself the story that I was just bad at math. It was just a thing I couldn't do. And that I was a slow learner, and that I wasn't smart, and that school just wasn't something I was ever going to do. But I really wanted to graduate, and I'm not even sure why. It was a point of pride for me. And so I worked really hard to graduate high school. And I probably worked a lot harder than I had to because I was starting at a place of, okay, so if I'm stupid, how am I going to do this? It was problem solving with the wrong information. It was starting from a place of negativity, and that's never going to help. Sometimes you've got to step back even farther, and it's taken me even longer because, as a matter of fact, I just decided to go to college for the first time a couple years ago, and I made the dean's list the first semester. And it's not that suddenly I realized, oh, I am good at this stuff. It was that I changed my idea about what it is I'm capable of. I changed my idea of the starting point.
Yeah.
But that takes a long time to come to if you keep telling yourself the same thing over and over again.
Yeah. And we can change. Our brain will get older, and a human brain is such amazing.
Yeah,
I've been studying it for so long now. So here's an example, and it's a little funny, but Chef Ramsay, Gordon Ramsay, I think you must have heard of him. He's on TV.
He's
the chef. So he's a good friend of mine. So many years ago, you know, I'm trying to break through because I'm just one in many, you know, and I want to make a difference to the addiction world, and I want to become famous for the main reason is I can help more people if people know I am.
Yeah.
So I was in my early stages and was sat in his house, and I always remember this, and he said to me, hey, Rob, do you know why I'm the best chef in the world? And I said, well, obviously you can cook. And he said, hell no, I don't know who can cook, who can't out there. How do you know? I said, well, why are you the best chef in the world? He said, because I tell people I am. And I thought, oh, wow. And it was really powerful. So I started calling myself the best addictionologist in the world. In fact, it's actually on my business card. And all of a sudden, people started treating me like that. And I don't know whether you've seen the movies, I Feel Pretty, but it's the same thing. Once other people start treating you differently, you start believing more in yourself and believing you can do this stuff.
Yeah.
And all you've got to do is create this persona. I'm cocky. Nobody in the world can do what I do. Nobody in the world offers a money-back guarantee. Nobody in the world has a 97% success rate because I'm passionate. You know, I don't lose, and I've been there and done it and got the education. And I'm arrogant about that. But you know something? People are getting well when they work with me because I truly believe that. Now, I don't care who else believes it, but I believe it. Now, whether that be true or false is de minimis as far as I'm concerned, because it's working. It's like if I told you a lie, Chris, you might believe, you might not. If I told you a lie often enough, you're going to believe it. But if I told you a lie real often enough, I'm going to start to believe it. Psychology 101.
Yes.
And that's what we need to look when we get people well or we're inspiring people, is not to bring someone down with a jab or a snide remark, but let's bring people up. There was a Japanese study many years ago with water. And they took like 10 gallons of water to one room and 10 gallons of the other. And they played and shouted horrible things. And it sounds crazy. They shouted horrible things at the water in room A. And room B, they played nice music and complimented the water. And there was an actual change in the molecule of the water. Like the one that was there, they were shouting bad things. That was damaged. It's that, I don't know. It was just damaged molecules and stuff. And it was just so fascinating. And to say that most of our body is water, it makes me think how interesting and how powerful the world would be if we complemented instead of bringing down. Because I compliment three people every day. It's part of what I have to do to stay sober and stay on the clean path. And it, I mean, I went into a store once, a big store around here called HEB, and was having a cake made. So we chose the cake and we wanted some writing on it. So we had to pick up the next day. But while I was there, this older lady came out. She must have been 65. And me and her just started, she started talking to me. We started bouncing off each other. And she was like, "You're a cheeky man. You, if you was 20 years younger," and I'm like, "Oh, well, let's do it now. And I'll leave my wife. Me and you'll run off." And we was bantering back and forth. And it was, I just loved doing that with people. So didn't think anything of it. Said bye. And next day I went in and, you know, to pick the cake up, which now had writing on it. And while I was seeing the guy who was giving me the cake, she came out from the back and she says, "Hey, can I have a word with you?" And I said, "Oh, of course you can." So I went to one side. "Chris, this is what she said to me. She said, I want to thank you for yesterday." So I said, "Why? We're just having fun." She said, "My husband died 3 months ago. And yesterday was my first day back because I was so heartbroken and I was so devastated and depressed that I had to take 3 months off work. And yesterday was my first day back. And I want to thank you because you made my day. And I just feel amazing after yesterday's chat." And so I thanked her and walked away. And again, I thought back, is I didn't know that I touched that woman that much to change her life. And I don't guess we ever do. But, you know, if we can touch more people like that by what we say, wouldn't the world be a better place?
Well, and when you're open to those things, do you find that they happen more often? Because I do.
Always. Always. Me and my wife joke. She says, you know, flirt, you know, joking. because I am. Guys or girls, I'll just... I'm the guy. I mean, don't forget me wrong. If I'm on my own, I need an audience, Chris.
Yeah.
Because if I'm on my own, I'm shy. If I walk into a store, I don't do this. But if I'm with a friend or a wife, I like to play up and I like to kind of, I'm the guy in the elevator that starts talking when everyone else is looking in seven or eight different directions because nobody talks in elevators. I'm the guy that says, "Oh my God, it's so quiet in here. Somebody died," and everyone starts laughing. I'm that guy.
Yeah.
But it's all what I have to do to make other people stay. It's not for me. I'm like the comedian. Or the, like, you know, the couple of comedians that's died from depression.
Yeah.
I'm the Robin Williams of the addiction world. I'm the guy that will make you laugh hysterically and you think my life's amazing. But it's not all the time amazing. There are some days when I can't get out of bed because I'm so depressed. Because when I work with somebody, I take part of their stuff back home with me. And I have to be really careful about looking after myself. But it's the reality, you know, that I have to do this. It's as, you know, simple as that.
There's a high level of empathy that's required to be really successful at this. I mean, you've really got to give a shit about people. You just have to. And taking that on, I've had instances just with this podcast where I've had conversations with people that never made it to air that haunted me. And I had to figure out how to accept gratitude from people because I discovered that's something I don't know how to do.
Yes.
And that can actually turn into a weird poison on the inside. If you don't know how to accept it, it reverberates and turns into this whole thing of, "Oh my God, I'm a fraud." The moment they discover that I don't know what I'm doing, I'm going to hurt people. I'm going to ruin people's lives. And honestly, those are things that are worth paying attention to, but it's not worth killing yourself over.
No, definitely not. Definitely.
So tell me a little bit about some of the fun stuff, because everybody has got, especially everybody that I know that has struggled with addiction and, you know, it brought them all the way to the bottom. There's always some, you know, quote unquote, fun stuff along the way. And you spent time as a musician. I've been a musician for most of my life as well. And so seeing that, my father is a substance abuse counselor, and he was a musician for a long time. And I remember when he got sober, he was still a musician playing in bars and all of that. And it was very interesting to see the shift in what kind of opinions he had about yes. playing music in bars when he wasn't drinking anymore.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tell me little bit about how playing music, like what kind of environment is that for someone who's struggling with something like this?
You know, you've really got to be strong in your own recovery, and then you can see the fun side of it.
Yeah.
I mean, I have literally no problem with people drinking. I think if I could do it successfully and if I could get away with it, yeah. I would do it as well. But I can't. It's like, you know, why moan when you go to a restaurant and you see people eating cheese and you can't eat cheese because you break out because you're allergic.
Yeah.
So just get on with it. So that's the kind of thing I have, which is absolutely wonderful. But you just see the funny side of life. I mean, even when I was drinking, and some of my musical stuff from Abbey Road is just stupid. I mean, just absolutely belly, you know, laughing, splitting. It's just, it's great. So yeah. I also like trying to see the fun side of it. I think life should be fun. I think life should be amazing. And
yes.
I think if you can make people laugh on a daily basis, you know, when I married my wife 5 years ago, I swore that I would make her laugh every day. And 5 years on, I've kept to it. I also promised her that a father that I would look after her financially and spiritually and mentally, and I've lived up to it. I think laughter is, and the funny side of things, is so important in today's world.
Oh yeah.
But there was a funny story at Abbey Road that we'd finished a session with Elton John, and it was a horrible night. In fact, the thunder was that bad we couldn't continue recording. So we all decided to head back to the Savoy Hotel, which is probably one of the most prestigious hotels in London.
Yeah.
And he had the penthouse suite. So up we go to the penthouse suite. There's cocaine in every flipping part of the suite that you can imagine. There's alcohol. There's a couple of beautiful girls. There's a couple of beautiful guys. There's me and three other guys from the studio plus Elton. And we're all sort of bowled into the room and we're having a great time and the music's on. And the next thing I hear was Elton was in the bedroom and he's on the phone to reception. And as I walk in, this is what I heard him telling the receptionist. If you don't stop the rain and the wind right now, I will never book into this hotel again. And I'm like hysterical. And I'm like, I grabbed the phone and I thought he was joking. The poor lady on the end, I was explaining to him that she had no control over the weather, but she'll ask her boss and try and do our best because he was so scared of him never booking in the hotel again. And I'm like, you clown. And I said to the receptionist, I'm so sorry. But again, take the funny side of it.
Yeah.
You know, let's twist it around and let's have some fun with it.
That had to have been a lot of pressure to be in a situation like that. Do you think that the pressure of a high-stakes situation like that, especially you've got to be a player of a certain caliber to be a session musician, yeah?
Yeah, definitely. And I want to talk about the addicted brain. So and then it will lead nicely into Abbey Road.
Perfect.
Is the addicted brain is very, very smart. The addicted brain will achieve things that the normal brain won't. So this is my findings and other people in the medical fraternity, is that the addicted brain or the alcoholic brain is rewired differently to the normal brain. It's part to do, which I don't really need to get into, the hypothalamus and the prefrontal cortex act differently to normal brains. So with the remapping of the brain as a child, because every person that suffers from alcoholism has childhood trauma, end of story. That's just the way it is. So quickly define childhood trauma. Well, anything less than nurturing to the alcoholic brain is child abuse. Get off there, you stupid idiot. How many times have I told you, you clown? Stop shutting off. All this stuff the addicted brain loves. But it's a very, very clever part of the body because it makes us succeed where no one else can.
Yeah.
And I was probably about 12 or 13 when I put in for a session bass playing job at a place called Strawberry Studios, which is in Stockport, just outside Manchester. So I'm a kid, but I've had that bass guitar around my neck since the age of probably 6.
Yeah.
I used to go to the bathroom with it. When I walked in the house, I used to wrap it around my neck. I used to eat with it, drove my mom crazy. I used to go to the restroom. I used, you know, everything around. So I'm pretty good by now. you know. So I auditioned for Strawberry Studios, and in one take, I got the job. So I knew, I mean, it's kind of the arrogance I have now. I can't do many things in this world, Chris, but there's two things I can do, and get people while I can play bass guitar or any other instrument. So after about 4 or 5 months there of doing jingles, I saw an ad in Melody Maker, which is a British musical magazine, which also adds in for musicians, okay? So I saw a bass player job, a session musician for Abbey Road, and I'm like, really? I'm going to apply for that. Now, I'm 16. So, yeah, there's people going for that job that are famous or part famous in the musical world as session musicians, and I turn up. And I was sat outside, and I had one beer before I went in, because by now I'm drinking to make sure I succeed.
Well, of course.
So I had my one beer, went in, did the session, went home, waited for the letter, got a second audition. I had 7 auditions for that job. So by the time I went in for my last audition, I was having 7 beers outside Abbey Road before I walked in. So I don't remember the session too much. But when I got home, I got a letter a couple of weeks later to say that I'd got the position. So what that told me was whenever I needed to be successful, I needed to drink. So I could sight read like crazy. Like, you know, I just put it in front of me, I'll play it within 3 seconds. Just give me the first note and the second note and I'm off.
Yeah.
And it's just a gift. It's a gift I've always had. Apparently when my mom used to take me around to my grandmother's, who had a piano, because all my family's musical, she sat me in front of it in the 80s. Of 3 or 4, and I would actually start bashing out a tune, whether it was Bar Bar Black Sheep or whatever it was. I had the ear, and I can't understand how my brother can build a house, because that's what he did. He built a house.
Yeah.
I'm like, I don't know how you can do that. But at the same time, I don't know why he can't play guitar like me, because it's so natural to me that I can't understand how people cannot get it.
Yeah.
You know, because it was just something that I obviously have the musical gene passed down. So even though that I was playing at a high level, it wasn't really a high level for me. It's like the genius, mathematic geniuses, when they go in class and they get bored.
Yeah.
You know, everyone else is going, God, this algebra is like doing my head in. And the guy's finished his exam within 3 or 4 minutes, and everyone else an hour later is still struggling. That's what I was like. I'm a savant in two areas, music and getting people well. And I don't mind telling people that today. But it's the only two things I can do. I can't paint a wall. I have no idea what's under the hood of my car. I cannot change a flat tire. I mean, all these things, negative things that I can't do, but there's only two things that can do.
It's so interesting the way that tends to be an area of focus when you're looking at yourself, is that those constant areas of, I played with Elton John, but God, why can't I just be better at these other things? You know?
And it kind of goes hand in hand. What you says is horrible at taking compliments.
Yeah.
You know, it was like when I used to go out anywhere, I'm still a little bit materialistic today just because I can afford it. I don't spend outside my means. But, you know, if I get a pair of Louis Vuitton shoes and somebody comes up and go, oh, nice shoe. Oh, yeah, I've had them years, you know.
Yeah.
Instead of saying, thank you, I've just bought them. Thank you. I always have to make an excuse because I can't accept that. And it's the same thing with what I do best. I'm always criticizing myself and I'm always telling you what I can't do. Instead of going, hey, Rob, you're an amazing doctor, you're an amazing musician, amazing. But what I do, hey, Rob, you're an amazing musician, I can't fix the car or I can't paint the door. It's like I wasn't asking you that. I was giving you a compliment about your talent that God gave you. And I'm like, and I had to work on that a lot. I had to work on that like crazy, Chris, just to be quiet and say thank you, you know, because it's really hard for me to take compliments.
So when did
When
did you first give yourself permission to be happy?
Wow, that's I'd say when I met my current wife. I've been married twice before, and they were disasters. Obviously, first one drinking, and second one just completely different. I should never got married. But my third wife is she kind of completes my life. We just have this amazing relationship. And it was only then, a year after I met her, to say to myself, you know, I'm pretty happy and I'm going to give myself permission, which is kind of good and kind of bad, Chris. And I'll tell you why it's pretty good. because I live to life on today's, I live on life's terms, and I live one day at a time. Like your interview right now, I got 30 minutes ago. I have no idea what I'm doing. 11, 12, 1, I know I'm busy, but I don't know what I'm doing because I live in the moment and I've got people around me that allow me to do that so I can be happy. But this is the way my head works. So I have, because I've got a couple of things going and because, you know, I've been doing this a long time, I have a healthy bank account. Obviously, my checking account is well into six figures mm-hmm. in my checking account. But do you know what I worry about, Chris? I worry about going broke tomorrow. I worry about where my next job's coming from. I worry if I'm going to have enough to pay the mortgage next month.
Yeah.
And there's literally probably $500,000 in there. And I'm always trying to self-sabotage and worry about, will I ever go homeless again? Will I, you know, it's absolutely insane. Because when I tell other people, I go, hey, you know, with my close friends, and I'm not saying this for bragging, I'm saying this because I want everyone to know how my head works. It's like, how much you got in your bank, Jimmy? Oh, I've got $6,000 in my bank. And I'm like, oh, I've got a lot more than that. And why isn't he worrying? Because he thinks he's wealthy. And I'm like, I'm not wealthy. And
yeah.
And people need to scream at me going, Rob, do you know that you are, you know, and you don't have to worry about anything. So it's just crazy. I don't know. It's just crazy.
I have that same exact thing. I think once you've experienced poverty, you recognize it as a reality. You know what I mean? You see it as a possible outcome.
Oh my God. Oh my God. That is just, once you've seen poverty, you realize it as a reality. That's probably one of the best lines I have ever heard. That is so true.
Yeah.
Wow. I've just had a spiritual awakening then. That is so, that is what it is. You know? There's a band in Manchester called James, and the well-known in England, but not all.
Yeah.
Oh, do you know James? Okay.
I know James.
So, yeah, it's called Sit Down, one of the biggest songs. And one of the lines was, if I haven't seen such riches, I could live with being poor. And it's like, you've just said one of them lines. It's like one of them lines that goes down in history. If I haven't seen poverty, you know, it's like the reality of it. Yeah, that sticks in my mind. But now I've seen the riches, I can't be poor again because I know that these things exist. I know that when I go to the airport, I get a chauffeur-driven limousine there. Yeah. I know that when I travel by air, I travel first class. All my old buddies are going, you pompous son of a frog, you know, you're crazy. It's like I do it because I can afford it and it's nice.
Yes.
Not to be waiting in big lines of security, but to walk through as like a VIP guest. I love that. I absolutely love it. And I'm scared of losing that. Because the reality of going broke and poverty and living in bus shelters and sleeping in under train tracks and all that, bridges and stuff like that, is such a reality that I think I still suffer from that today. Wow, this is a deep conversation, Chris. I've never gone here before with some of these questions you're asking. Freaking awesome. Awesome.
Well, one of the things that you can think about in regards to that too is that you've already done it. You've already been there. You've already come back from that edge. So even if you started to slide, I think you'd be able to recognize you'd already be farther ahead because you've already done it once. And so it wouldn't be as difficult and it wouldn't take as long. And you'd live. You'd survive. You've already seen the worst thing that can happen. Now what?
And you're right there, because after, when I came to America, I married a lady, a fantastic lady, but we weren't that compatible and we should never got married. We should have stayed best friends.
Yeah.
But when we broke up, I never had no friends here. It was only been here about a year or 2 years. So when we broke up, I had nobody to turn to, and she took all the money and she took the house, and I left with a suitcase with my clothes in it. So I booked into a friend of mine halfway house, and I had to stay there for a bit. And this was like 6-7 years ago, maybe 6 years ago. And it was horrible. I had no money, I had nothing. So I was kind of homeless again. Although it wasn't as bad because I had these people around me who kept encouraging me. And what I've done in the last 5 years is where I am today. It's not been over 30 years. This has only been over 5 years. So you're right. You know, even though I was down in that spot again, I kept a good sense of humor about it.
Yeah.
I kept a positive. I remember when I got a job driving a van, because I was out of the industry. I wanted nothing to do ever again. I'd hung my PhDs up and I was done. And I was driving a van, and they were happy days. and yet I'm here again today. So you're right. It can be done again. Maybe I have some insights that I didn't have the first time around.
Yeah, there's a number of things that the brain requires to be happy. And I don't know if your brain truly knows the difference between what kind of dopamine dose to give you for waking up in the morning and making your bed, doing a 5-minute walk around the block or winning an award. You know what I mean? It's all success. The moving forward and getting pleasure from the small bits of joy is almost the same as getting pleasure from the big bits of joy. It's all joy. Yes. Joy is all the same thing. It's all the same pie. And little bits of it, big bits of it, they're all sweet. They're all wonderful. But sometimes it's important to recognize those small things when they're happening because they're just as wonderful.
Yes. Yes, definitely.
So tell me a little bit about how you decided that you needed to go into recovery.
Well, I have two crazy stories. First of all, I was homeless, drinking, all this, six suicide attempts, two actual suicides where they brought me back on the side of the road. And one rainy morning, Monday morning, Sunday night,
that's all right. Sorry. I got dogs too.
Sorry. One real rainy Sunday morning, I was walking down a side street in Manchester. I had no shoes on my feet because they'd been stolen the night before, and I broke down to my hands and knees, and I've been on the streets for so long, and I just started to cry. I started to cry because, not because I'd lost my wife, my kids, and everything like that. It's because the first time in my life I realized I couldn't stop drinking.
Yeah.
And it took me to that depth of the crying children, the broken wives, the torment of mom and dad, the shame and the remorse and everything that I went through from an absolute successful businessman to a broken man who everybody, Chris, had given up on. I used to hear in 12-step rooms, don't mess around with Rob Kelly. He's a waste of time. He's just going to die. You're wasting your time with him. Don't mess with him. I used to hear that in meetings.
Yeah.
So I was done. I looked up to the sky. I'm on my hands and knees. I'm going to give you a visual that's really powerful. I'm on my hands and knees. I'm looking at the ground. There's tears mixing with the rain hitting the pebble concrete. And I looked up and I said, if there's a God up there, I can't do this on my own anymore. And 30 seconds later, at 2:30 in the morning, a guy came around the corner who'd missed his last bus home. He was on a Bible study. And he bumped into me. And my life changed from there. He took me back to his house.
Wow.
You know, I went to a 12-step meeting with him. From the 12-step meeting, I met a guy. I met a guy who called himself a recovered alcoholic. And his name was John. So miracle number one, got on my hands and knees. Guy came around. I'm at his house now, staying at his house in 24 hours. Within 48 hours, part of the deal, staying in his house, he had to come to the 12-step meeting with him. Met a guy called John who called himself a recovered alcoholic. Asked him to be my sponsor. He said no, but I'll be a spiritual advisor for 12 weeks. So we studied the big book of AA, which is a great piece of literature. Mm-hmm. I went round to his house, Chris, every week on a Wednesday to do homework about this book. And it was phenomenal. He showed me stuff and taught me stuff that I knew I'd never drink again. He taught me stuff and showed me stuff in that book that nobody else had seen. It was absolutely phenomenal. After I finished with him, about a week later, I got my first job. 2 weeks after that, I moved into my own little apartment. A month after that, I got my first paycheck. I went to the gas station and I bought him a little teddy bear and a card. And I walked back to that man's house. Now, bear in mind, Chris, that I'd walked there 12 times before and walked on because I couldn't afford the bus there. So I walked there again. I got to the apartment and knocked on the door. And there was no answer. And a woman next door answered the door and she said, can I help you? And it says, can you tell me where John's moved to? And she said, there's been no one in that apartment for the 3 months that I've lived here. So I let her close the door thinking she was wacky. And when she closed it, I went down to the left-hand side and I knocked on the door. And a guy came and I said, can you tell me where John's relocated to? And he said, and I quote, I've been here for 2 years and there's been no one in that apartment as far as I know for that 2 years. Never found that guy.
Wow.
Went back to the meeting where I'd seen him. And this is where it gets a bit ugly. Because I nearly beat somebody up in there because he thought he made me sound as if I'm going insane. And I said to him, can you remember John, the guy I was speaking to? And he said, John. I said, the white hair, white beard, like, you know, don't remember any John. I said, I was over the coffee machine talking to him. And he said, Rob, you was over at the coffee machine talking to yourself. He was laughing at you. Well, I grabbed him by the scruff of the neck and a fight broke out. I actually punched him a couple of times because I thought he was embarrassing me in front of his friends.
Yeah.
Turns out he wasn't. I never found that guy. And he's adamant to this day that I was talking to myself in that corner. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
So I kind of didn't. So back to the original question, I kind of didn't have any choice. You know, it's like it's like I was thrown into this new life by this spiritual awakening and change that I come across, and I've never looked back.
That's incredible.
I know. Every time I tell somebody that, they all go, I've just got hairs in the back of my neck stood up. And I just say, well, I have a bunch of stories like that, which makes me realize I'm in the right place and everything's going to be good. But there's loads of miracles happened to me, Chris, over the years. It's just crazy.
Well, and you know, it's exactly like the woman in the shop who you had the moment with. It's the same thing. If you're open to it, it's kind of like, it's almost that law of attraction thing, right? The things that you're focusing on, the things that you're paying attention to will come to you. But I don't think it's quite that intentional. I think it's really about you as a person, you know, whether or not you're open to the experience is whether you're even able to have the experience.
Yes. That's another great quote and idea. Yeah. You've got to be open to that.
Absolutely.
You know, you have to realize what's going on. And, you know, we have a saying here at Rob Kelly Recovery Group, and that is empowered people empower people.
Yes.
And that's it, you know, but you have to be open to be empowered. And you have to realize
really do.
The realization that you can change somebody's life on a daily basis is very scary to own, Chris, because at first you go, well, not me. I'm, you know, I don't want to get my ego. And, you know, my ego went when they took my kids off me at the ages 1 and 3. I don't have ego. I have ambition. I have pride and I have a strive for success. But to actually own that, you know, where other people fail, I know millions of other people, not just me. We can change people's lives in 30 seconds, but you have to own it and you have to accept you can do that. And you have to be in the right frame of mind to accept that. And that's what I found the hardest, coupled with, thank you. You know, the compliments, I still find hard today.
You know, what made it a little easier for me? What made it easier for me was I came to the conclusion that it's not about me. It's about the importance that I put on the information that I have. I have information that can help people. I have stories of things that I've lived through that can help people. And by taking all of those things and even having conversations with other people and them sharing their stories with other people and their information, it's about the sharing of the important information and me remembering it. So it's not really about me. It's about my ability to remember things and pass them on for you to use or not use.
Yeah, I like that. I do like that.
So what was it about your personality that made things difficult for you as far as people being either unwilling to help or writing you off? I mean, was there some kind of a shift in your own personality that had to take place before you could interact with humanity?
I was just unteachable, you know. I was very, you see, there was a time in my life, I always remember it, and I've been going to this place for ages. I don't know if it was a 12-step meeting or something, and I didn't know anybody. So if I don't know anybody, like, today I'm different, but back then, I just sit on my own. I wouldn't go up to anybody and introduce myself because, goodness me. Now, it's definitely because today I'm well-known, you know, with the TV and all that stuff. So it's different today. I could walk in and somebody knows me somewhere. But back then, and I'm only talking about 6 or 7 years ago, so I'd walk in and not say anything. So a friend come up to me and he said, Rob, you need to start chilling out. So I said, why? Well, you walk in all these rooms and people just think you're cocky and arrogant. And I was like, what? I'm not cocky and arrogant. I just don't know what to say to anybody. I'm embarrassed. And we had a real long conversation about that. It's like, you need to realize who the hell you are, Rob. And this is something I teach today, is if we could swap places for 2 minutes with one of my patients, all your problems would be over, because we never realize who we are. We never realize how much power we carry when we walk into a room. So I'm shy and I'm scared, Chris, of speaking to somebody in case they don't like me or say the wrong thing. And it comes over as being arrogant and cocky. Because I'm a big guy. I was an ex-bodybuilder, you know, and also an ex-fighter. When I was on the streets, I fought bare-knuckle fighting to earn some money to eat and drink. So I'm kind of an imposing guy. And even today, my wife, I'll get him to speak to somebody, and I'll come off, and God, he was quiet. Like, he didn't really come back with me or anything. And my wife will say, Rob, he's intimidated by you. And I am shocked. And I go, there is no way is he intimidated. And it took me a few years before I realized that I need to go up and go, hey, this is, I'm Rob, good to see you. And they'll do the same. Other than that, I look intimidated. And if I don't speak and I'm all shy, that's how I'll come over. So today when I walk in, I'm the first to shout across the room something. And, of course, that's taken as being cocky as well, because I'm loudmouth now. Yeah. Now I'm not arrogant and not speaking. Now I'm a loudmouth, so I can't really win. But I do win over people when they find out, especially going coffee afterwards, that, hey, this guy's a pretty cool guy. He's pretty shy, you know, but he can be outgoing at the point and places, especially when it's around music or around addiction. Unteachable. Now, today I'm teachable, Chris. I'm open to anything. Like, there was a counselor of mine 3 or 4 years ago. She's a psychotherapist, so she knew her stuff. And she said, hey, Rob, the program that you invented is amazing, but do you think we can do this, this, or this with it as well? Well, I'd never spoke to her since. I wouldn't speak to her. I thought she was an idiot. How dare you question my program? And it's the same thing. Why aren't you open to these things, Rob? Are you insecure? Check. Are you jet? Check. Are you scared somebody might run off with all your patients? Check. And one of the reasons why I couldn't stand to hear that from her is because of my insecurity.
Yeah.
You know, and my lack of confidence. Today, she's a partner of mine on our podcast called Breaking Through Addiction. She's a great friend of mine. But it took me looking at me to realize that, hey, you've got to be teachable, Rob. You've got to be approachable. You've got to be open to new things. And this, Chris, this isn't an end product you're talking to. This is a work in progress. Do you know what I mean? It's like, I'll never be perfect. I'm perfectly imperfect.
Yeah.
And I'm okay with that. But I love admitting my faults today. It's like a post on Facebook a couple of weeks ago. I listed all my faults. You know, I don't like this. I think it's bad when we do this. And I listed them all because my therapist told me to. And I felt so good after. It's like other people see me on a pedestal when they see me on TV and they think, you know, I'm all stuck, sat in my big house on the big hill. And it's like, I will always have my heart in the gutter with the suffering alcoholic, in the trenches.
Yeah.
You know, I don't feel comfortable in a boardroom with other doctors discussing addiction. I don't feel comfortable with some of our sponsors. I'm talking about monetary sponsors, sat in a business in a boardroom talking. I'm comfortable sat in a down and out broken 12-step meeting with guys living on the streets. I mean, I always will be.
Yeah.
I mean, people come to us every single day for donations for different, you know, big companies that are doing well. No, I'm giving my guy to the guy that stood in 103 temperature on the corner of the traffic lights begging for his lunch or his beer. I'm giving my money to them because I can relate to them.
Yeah. Yeah. That's everything. That's absolutely everything. Having been there and having been through those experiences, there's different outcomes for how it could shape you as a human being.
Yes.
And really, honestly, you get lucky if empathy is what you come back with.
Yes.
That's a blessing.
It is. It is a blessing. When I look back, you know, my life is amazing today. I mean, it really is. But I'll still find fault when
of course.
I'm feeling down. I mean,
yeah, let's you know, not go crazy. Of course, right? You're still going to find.
I know. And it drives me insane, Chris. It drives me insane. It's like, why can't you just sit back and be happy? You know, it's like it's never enough. I mean, I took my car in the other day to have its first service. I got a brand new car. I mean, it costs like it costs six figures. It's like, are you insane? And I'm driving home in this car, half the price of mine, calling the manager to complain, how dare you give me a car like this? So it's a work in progress.
Yes.
You know, my wife's like looking at me. My wife's a great grounder, by the way, Chris. She's like, I remember doing a thing at studio in Paramount Studios, and they look after your chauffeurs here. So I come off stage. I come off a live show. And I walk to the back and we go in the green room. I get my stuff and I walk out and I shout to the producer, where's my limousine? Because now I'm frustrated. I want to get to the airport and get back home. Next thing I knew, there was a slap across my face and it's my wife. And she said, listen to me. It's not your limousine. You're lucky to be here. Start inspiring and thanking people. If I ever hear you say again, you will never come back into the house because I'll change the locks. And I thought, wow. But she keeps me grounded. It's like, yes, Rob, how dare you do that? Because I can get carried up with the bullshit that I hear and listen to.
Of course. You know? We're all capable of that.
I know. It's crazy. Crazy.
Well, I mean, I could talk to you for 100 years.
Where's the hour gone?
I know. Exactly. Where is it gone? I want to end with one last thing. If you could give one piece of advice for anyone who's listening and they're thinking that they might be struggling with some form of addiction, what is the first step?
Open dialogue. Talk to somebody. I'd rather you talk to somebody and it all get put out of proportion and you're not really got a problem, you're just going through a phase, and keep it to yourself. Alcoholism and addiction loves isolation.
Yeah.
It loves quiet mouths. Talk to somebody. Talk to anybody. Talk to me. Hey, call me up. You know, just anybody. It makes no difference who it is. You just need to speak to somebody. And stop living in fear. You know, alcoholics and addicts and some other people make practical, this so-called practical decision based on fear.
Yeah.
You will never know how powerful you are unless you start taking and believing that you are. You will never know what you're capable of achieving unless you take that step and start to believe in. Remember what Gordon Ramsay said? Because I tell everybody I am. Start thinking that way.
Yes.
Talk to someone about your addiction. Get into a 12-step meeting. Get some therapy or treatment or 12-step meeting. Get recovered. Get your life back. Get back on track. And then go out and achieve something that you've never believed possible in your life. Because the addicted brain is one of the smartest brains around. So I don't like to focus on the illness too much because that's a done deal when you come here. It's a done deal. We offer a money-back guarantee with a 97% success rate. I'll give you your money back if you don't attain everything we tell you you're going to attain. Nobody in the world does that, by the way. Nobody. So you can do this. You can do this, guys. It's so simple. If you only knew how easy this was. Quantum physics tells us we can be, say, 12 places at the same time on a basketball. Quantum physics is a science. It's a well-known. So yeah. I can be 12 places on a basketball at the same time, guys. Where do I want to be? I want to be over near the goal. I want that job, that car, that wife. I want to be over near the goal. So when I get the ball, I'm going to pop it in the basket and be the hero of the game. How do I get there? Listen very carefully, guys. I can already see it there. I can visualize it. I walk over and I take that position. And life is as simple as that. Visualize it, walk over, and take it. What you can visualize in your head, you can hold in your hand.
Thanks for talking to me today.
Oh, just, you know, I do that many podcasts and I do that many talking to people that they kind of blend into one another. But I want to tell you today, you've asked some questions that nobody else has asked. You had me intrigued. I mean, by the time an hour comes, I'm ready to get off and do something else. I'm not ready to get off. I could speak all day with you, Chris. thank you for what you do. Thank you for the inspiration that you give with this deal. And thank you for being an awesome, awesome podcast interviewer today, because I just thoroughly enjoyed that.
I absolutely loved talking to you. It's great when I can have a conversation with somebody like this, and I feel like I've got all the energy in the world. This is really going to help me a lot today.
Excellent. And me too. That's just it's a win-win all the way around. I love it. We'll do this every morning at 7 a.m. just to get us both in the mood for the day. Oh, excellent.
What did I tell you? Was that not one of the greatest hours in podcasting you've ever heard in your life? This guy is an absolute dynamo. And if you want to get more Rob in your life, and I know that you do, go to robkelly.com. That's Rob with two B's and Kelly with two Y's. Why? Because you should. And you should also find him on Instagram at Rob Kelly Recovery Group. And if you haven't yet checked out the music album that I just put out called When We Could Go Outside under the band name Shark with an exclamation point, I highly recommend it. It's fun. It's the kind of show that we used to take for granted. It's just a small rock and roll show in a tiny burrito joint in Denver, Colorado. The kind of show we would all go see when we could go outside. But until next time, whenever that may be, don't kill yourselves out there.